Acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 109, Subversive Stitches, Sunday, February 7th, 2016. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. This week's episode features the following segments: The Back Porch, The Front Porch, Ever-Expanding Skill Set, Off the Shelf, and so forth. Thanks for tuning in. Recently, there has been a new iTunes review by Rana Casement. Thank you so much. And several new ratings on iTunes. I really appreciate that. And thank you also to everyone who has dropped in to give a comment, ask a question, or share some insights on the Yarns at Yin Hu group on Ravelry. It's a board that hosts great conversation and ideas and links from very, very smart knitters, cooks, and crafters. So if you haven't already checked it out, you should join in. The Back Porch. This week, I completed a second pair of socks. This year, I'm working on knitting socks and finding a pattern or a recipe for socks that I like to knit and that fit me well. This pair of socks was begun in February of 2015. I was using Very Pink Knits pattern for knitting socks two at a time. And I knit the entire ribbed cuff and stopped. Sometime last winter, I stopped. So I picked those up again and I switched to US size 1 needles. My 40 inch circular had been US 1.5. So I dropped down a little bit in needle size. And again, I used the strong heel, which is a cuff down variation on the Flegel heel, as far as I can tell. And it's notable in that you don't need to put stitches on hold. You knit the heel and continue knitting the front of the foot at the same time. To do this knitting, I used a new tool that was sent to me by my friend Mary Beth. She sent me a US size 1 9-inch circular. And I really like using this needle for the strong heel because you don't put any stitches on hold and you're working the entire circumference of the sock. So by the time you're done with the heel increases, that's, I think, a third again more stitches than you originally had on the needle. And for my DPNs, I have some new signature DPNs, but they're not incredibly long, and I only have 4 of them. So that was getting to be a little bit uncomfortable keeping that number of stitches on the needles. And I liked the circular for doing the heel. And then I switched back to the DPNs because I feel like I have a little more control and a little bit neater and tighter stitches with the DPNs. So I switched back to them to continue knitting the foot and the toe. I tried a couple different variations on toe decreases for these socks, and I'm not completely satisfied with either of them. So I think with some new socks that I plan to cast on soon, I will keep the ribbed cuff. I will keep the strong heel, but I might try a few decreases in the instep of the foot to get a snug fit around the instep. And definitely I will try a new toe. Also, I feel like I don't know exactly when to start the toe, because when I try the sock on in process and look for between 1.5 and 2 inches to the end of my toe, that it seems like there's a lot of knitting left to do. But then when I finished these socks and put them on, it seemed like I had done too much knitting and that I hadn't really started the toe soon enough. So which is exciting, because the prospect of less knitting for socks to fit me is pretty interesting. So I think I will work on the toe a little bit more. Yet another change that I will be making on my next pair of socks is to try US size 0 double pointed needles. I think my gauge on ones might still be a little bit too loose. I would like to get 8 to 9 stitches per inch, and on this last pair, I was getting just under 7.5 stitches per inch. So I attended a sale at my local yarn store, Mountain Knits and Pearls, yesterday. There was a 30% discount if you shopped before noon, so I did. And I picked up a set of Knitter's Pride Carbons in US size 0. And these are exciting because there are 5 needles, and they are also a bit longer than the signatures I have. So I will be trying those and seeing if I like the fabric of the sock. I will still cast on 64 stitches and just see if using the US size zeros results in a snugger fit. But if it doesn't, then I might try 56 stitches on a future sock. I have also completed this week the second item in my set of a hat, cowl, and mitts using the same design motif. So way back in October, I was working on and completed the Bushwalk Beanie, a fantastic hat design by Amy Vandelaar with a beautiful fern fronds pattern. So that is completed and it has a lovely cashmere lining, very warm. And then I used some DK weight yarn in a coordinating color, but this is a much more variegated yarn, and US size 8 needles. I cast on for a cowl and I adapted the fern fronds design to the number of stitches in my cowl. I did a tubular cast on for the cowl, and I also did a tubular bind off. This looks great. The two pieces so far look fantastic together. And so the next and final project for this set will require, I think, the most ingenuity in adapting the design. And it's a pair of mittens. I've made a lot of fingerless mitts, but I've only made one pair of mittens, and it was a thrummed pair in a very thick Aran weight yarn. So I can't use that pattern. I need to use something that will work with the beautiful fingering weight yarn from Dirty Water Dye Works. And this is the same yarn I used for the hat. So far I am using my signature US size 1 needles, and I have cast on 56 stitches for the cuff of the mitten, and I did a tubular cast on, and I will be knitting in 1x1 rib for approximately 2.5 inches. I want a nice deep cuff. Maybe I'll even go to 3 inches for the cuff. I want something that really pulls up under the sleeve of my coat and keeps my wrists warm. I've been perusing a number of different mitten patterns on Ravelry, and probably I will not follow any one pattern, but use the ideas to custom fit a mitten of my own. The front porch. This month, I plan to continue my endeavor to think about coordination between sewn and knitted objects, and I'm taking a riff on the theme of thistle. I've ordered some beautiful fabric from Anna Maria Horner in the thistle pattern. So it's a black ground with a very deep orange thistle design. It's incredibly bold. And with that fabric, I plan to make another version of the Esme dress from the Lotta Jansdotter book. This time, I think I will not use the kaftan neckline. I will just use the more boat neck style. And I also plan to put in a side zip and fit the body of the dress a little bit more so I can just trim down some of the excess fabric and get even a slimmer silhouette from that. To coordinate with this dress, I have cast on the thistle scarf, a design by Tin Can Knits. I really enjoy knitting Tin Can Knits patterns. I find the directions very easy to follow, they're very well edited, and the design is very smart. I don't know that I've ever knit a scarf. I was looking through my projects, and I think I've only crocheted a scarf since I started to... Oh, that's not true. I've done an entrelac version of a knitted scarf. But it's been a while since I've made any scarves. I became devoted to shawls, so I thought this would be a nice change of pace. And there's a beautiful thistle design on about a third of the scarf, and then column lace for two-thirds. So I thought that would be an interesting combination, and certainly I would get a lot of use out of a scarf. So at my local yarn store yesterday, I indulged in some yarn for the project. I purchased Mirasol Sulca Legato, which is a wool alpaca and silk blend. I'm using US size 4 needles, and I have begun the first repeat of the lace. So with this pattern, you knit the lace first and then you go into the column lace, which is substantially less difficult. This lace is difficult lace. It does have rest rows, so you're purling on the wrong side. But I find it difficult to grasp any rhythm of the pattern. I need to look at the chart every time. There are written directions as well as a chart, which is handy just to double check. But one thing I often do for lace is to use stitch markers between the repeats. And this lace shifts so that the markers don't remain in the same place. There's shifting border and then shifts within the design. It's pretty complicated. I am still using markers, however, and moving them because no matter what happens with the lace, there are 10 stitches in each repeat. And I find it helpful to have my stitch markers there so that on the wrong side row, I can just count to make sure that there are 10 stitches between each of those markers. And that helps me notice an error in my knitting on the wrong side row so that I can fix it more easily. And then on the next right side row, everything is perfect and ready for the next set of directions. So far, I'm halfway through the first lace repeat, so maybe it will become more intuitive as I knit, but I'm really enjoying the texture and the delicacy of this beautiful silky blend of yarn, and the color is a beautiful lilac that I associate with the color of a thistle in the landscape. Once again, the pattern design is Thistle, a scarf by Tin Can Knits. I am knitting it on US size 4 needles in Mirasol Sulca Legato in the lilac colorway. Ever-expanding skill set. This month, the chosen ingredient for hashtag Power Pantry is jams and jellies. And rather than tell you about all of the cooking I've been doing with jams and jellies, because there has been none, I will instead respond to a question from Melinda, also known as Yarnder Woman of the Yarnder Woman podcast, who asked about the definition for jams and jellies. And she assumed that maybe there was some difference between the American terms and the ones used in Australia. And I had never thought about that, so I thought it would be a good idea to look into it and give kind of an overview of this type of food preserves. If I had thought more carefully about the term to use for hashtag Power Pantry this month, I probably should have selected preserves. The definition of preserves is fruit that has been preserved or suspended using sugar. And all of the things that I'm going to talk about fit that definition in some way or another, although there are slight variations. So Melinda had originally asked about the difference between jams and jellies. And the way I think about it is that a jam is whole fruit that has been suspended in a sugar solution. And jelly is juice that has been made into a preserve. So jams will always have more texture and jellies less texture. Jams are made with fruits like strawberries, raspberries, blackberries, and jellies can also be made from those things, but first all of the pulp of the fruit needs to be strained out. Jellies can also be made with juices of fruits that really don't have a lot in the way of seeds, or that you would not use the rind or the skin of the fruit or other aspects of the fruit. I remember that when my mom was making some forms of jam, particularly raspberry jam, if it had been a dry summer and the fruit was exceptionally seedy, she would still make jam. It would still have texture to it and have the seeds and the pulp of the fruit, but she would take out about a third of the pulp and make a little bit finer texture to the jam. Also in the U.S., we use peanut butter and jelly as a type of sandwich to refer to a sandwich with either jam or jelly. That's my experience anyway. We always said peanut butter and jelly, and we were almost always eating jam on our sandwich, not jelly. Another term within this category of foodstuffs is the compote, which has whole pieces of fruit and often no additional thickener because the pectin in the fruit is able to serve as a thickening agent. There's a conserve or a conserve, And that typically refers to a type of jam made from multiple fruits. Usually jams and jellies are a single fruit. There's also marmalade, and this is a type of citrus preserve in which the whole fruit minus the seeds is used. So you get this delicious texture, and also in addition to the sweetness from the fruit and sugar, you get the bitterness of the rind and the peel of the fruit. Marmalade is one of my favorite types of preserve. And there's also a chutney, which is a less sweet version of a compote. So typically several types of fruits. And sometimes there are dried fruits as well as fresh. And spices are added to a chutney so that it has a bit more of a savory sensation and is also used as an accompaniment with meats and other savory foods. I will provide a link to the Epicurious page that I referenced to get this information. I really enjoy the epicurious.com website for information about background, about food. And I have two plans for this week involving jams and jellies. One is that I will be making another recipe of the Lintz dough that I used around Christmas time. I just made a vanilla version and the dough has been made. It is wrapped tightly and sitting in my refrigerator. And I will be cutting that dough into heart shapes and filling the cookies with some variety of jam. I haven't decided. I might do a couple different kinds of cookies. And then I will be drizzling melted chocolate over those cookies, which I think will be perfect for Valentine's Day. I didn't make that version at Christmas time and I really missed them. So I thought they would be a good Valentine's treat. And the second thing I will be doing is a more savory preparation. Around Christmas time, I made some spicy, tangy meatballs using ground turkey. And they were kind of an appetizer. I put them in a glaze, and I don't even remember exactly what I used for the glaze, but I think it would be ideal for some type of jam or jelly, in addition to ground ginger and maybe some other spices, soy sauce, that type of thing, to make it very sweet and sticky and tangy. Instead of serving them as an appetizer this week, I plan to put them on a bed of soba noodles and sautéed vegetables, cabbage, that sort of thing. So it's like an Asian dish. Those are my plans. I will put links to recipes for you in case you'd like to try out any of these ideas in your own kitchen. Off the shelf. This month, I have attempted to devote some time each day to an embroidery project. One of my goals over the past several years has been to do more in the way of embroidery. I have not been able to commit 20 minutes a day to embroidery, but I have found more time for it, and I am very eager to complete the design because it's on this multitasker tote that I really like and I'd like to get some more use out of. So I want to finish the bag, put the embroidery on it, and seam up the inside so that I can continue using it. I've selected a embroidery theme from a Japanese robe design. So I have this. It's kind of like an adult coloring book, I suppose. I chose it because I thought that there were interesting ideas for embroidery in the book. And it's a whole bunch of outlines of different motifs and designs from Japanese garments. And the one I chose is a beautiful crane that fills a circle. There's some vegetation in there also. And it was originally an embroidery design for a woman's robe. Since I'm working on a denim type fabric, I can't really put this on a window and trace the design. So I'm just working from the design and transferring elements of it via sketch with a white pencil and then embroidering each part as I go. So I started with the outline and I did a beautiful stem stitch in a brilliant fuchsia color to outline the complete design. That took about an hour. And then I spent a little bit of time tracing some of the vegetation into the left side of this outline and selecting three colors that I will use for, it's almost a turnip looking fruit and then some leaves. So I chose three colors and I threaded a bunch of needles and I examined a couple of stitch dictionaries and Rebecca Rehnquist's videos on Creative Bug to determine what type of stitches I might use for the next portion. So I'm just slowly working my way through the design, and I think I will save the elements of the crane's head and face for last because that will probably be the most difficult aspect of the design, and I wanted to sort of warm up with less important elements first. I think stitching is very therapeutic. It's similar in some ways to knitting because I think the use of color makes it motivating, I suppose. And seeing the design emerge is definitely interesting and appealing. When I am not able to work on embroidery because of a crazy schedule so far this month, I have been trying to spend some time each evening reading from a book called The Subversive Stitch. I heard about this book because I listened to an interview with Rebecca Rehnquist on Thread Cult. Thread Cult is a really fascinating podcast about the fiber arts, but more in the sewing and garment making aspect of fiber arts, a little bit less with the knitting. And episode 36, which unfortunately is the last episode that's been recorded, this was sometime in July, features Rebecca Rehnquist. And I dearly hope the creator of this podcast will put more episodes out sometime soon because they're very well produced and very informative. I really enjoy Rebecca Rehnquist's take on embroidery. It's somewhat irreverent. And in the interview, she mentions that she started embroidering in some sort of a feminist art theory class in college. And the text they were reading was The Subversive Stitch, Embroidery and the Making of the Feminine by Rosika Parker. I was interested and ordered a copy of the book. And today I would like to read a bit to you that I hope you will find of interest. It's in the third chapter called Fertility, Chastity, and Power. By the 14th century, a man not only displayed his political allegiance through embroidered garments, but his wife could also have her garments embroidered with her own coat of arms, impaled with her husband's. Embroidery was thus politically and artistically a leading English art, sharing with painting and sculpture the task of affirming the power of the church, the crown, and the nobility. But who were the embroiderers at this time of extraordinary expansion? Embroidery was produced in both secular workshops and in religious houses. Convents were centers of embroidery production. The majority of cloistered nuns were drawn from the nobility. 6 hours of a nun's day were devoted to labor, and nunneries employed people to perform the mundane tasks of the establishment, leaving embroidery as one of the few acceptable forms of work for the nuns. But the church had reservations about convent embroidery. In the 6th century, an edict had been issued forbidding nuns to work with precious stones and depict flowers. In 747, the time nuns spent embroidering was limited, and in 1314, an injunction was sent to the English convents of Nunkeeling, Yettingham, and Wickham that no nun should absent herself from divine service, quote, on account of being occupied with silk work, unquote. The edicts were prompted both by the church's view of women and by the conditions within convents. Embroidery was deeply associated with self-adornment as a mark of social power. In relation to women, this spelled vanity. The concepts of chastity as a virtue and vanity as a vice were both employed as mechanisms of control over women, who were dubbed by the church as more dangerous to men than the poison of asps and dragons. There is, though, no doubt that convent embroidery was not always dedicated to the church. When the writer and politician Christine de Pisan visited her daughter at the Dominican Abbey of Poissy in the 15th century, the nuns presented their visitors with decidedly secular embroideries, belts and purses worked in silk and gold thread. The Ancren Rule, or rules for anchoresses, frowned on this practice, ordering women to make no purses to gain friends therewith, but shape and sew and mend church vestments and poor people's clothes. Eileen Power, in her study of English nuns, surmises that nuns eked out their income by doing fine needlework for ladies of the world. However, a group of religious women, known to be embroiderers, cut across the image of the worldly embroidering nun. Women shared the prevailing religious enthusiasm of the late Middle Ages. They were not only involved in the religious poverty movements, the new mendicant orders founded by St. Dominic and St. Francis in the 13th century, but also founded their own movements. Among them were the Beguines, a non-establishment reform movement that originated in Liège at the end of the 12th century. Theirs was an organization with no hierarchy, no system of permanent vows, and no rigid structure. They sometimes lived in groups in a house inherited by one of their number and slowly set up convents. Members were required to give up all their possessions and, instead of begging, were to live by the labor of their hands. Drawn initially from the nobility, the work they knew was embroidery. The movement spread quickly through France and Germany. Matthew Paris commented in 1243 that they have so multiplied within a short time that 2,000 of them have been reported in Cologne and neighboring cities. However, the embroidering Beguines were to be a short-lived movement. "I would have them married or thrust into an approved order," wrote the Bishop of Olmutz to the Pope in 1273. The women were condemned by the Church Council of 1312 at Vienne with a document which revealingly began, "Since these women promise no obedience to anyone." Finally, the Archbishop of Cologne ordered the association to be dissolved. Although nuns and holy women were known for their embroidery, the art was not restricted to one sex alone. Monks, too, embroidered. For example, Thomas Selmeston, a monk who died in 1419, was remembered as an outstanding embroiderer, for he was in the art of embroidery a most cunning artificer, having none like him. Similarly, in secular workshops, both sexes embroidered. These gained importance over ecclesiastical workshops from the 13th century onward, when increased demand for embroidery necessitated greater capitalization. I thought that was fascinating, and as I'm reading, I have been thinking about the really exquisite display of ecclesiastical garments and church vestments that was on display when Fernanda and I visited St. Mary's on the Hill last spring. In addition to the cashmere goats, which were so cute, and the shopping, inside the convent area, there was also a beautiful display of products that had been made by girls, young women in New York City who were being taught embroidery as a means of having a lucrative career option, as opposed to maybe some of the other ways of earning money available to young women of very little means. And so they would often make copies of vestments with very, very fine embroidery work as part of their learning. And it was just really exquisite to see these on display. And as I'm reading, I'm thinking about some of the issues having to do with women's work and handwork and the, I guess, power play that was going on in the church. Certainly the display of things that Fernanda and I saw was of a later period than is being discussed right now in this subversive stitch text. But I think it's all part of one continuous story. So I will continue reading this month, The Subversive Stitch, Embroidery and the Making of the Feminine by Rosiska Parker. And if I have anything else that strikes me as interesting to share, I will certainly do that in a later episode. And so forth. I was very fortunate this week to receive messages from Jan Marie and Barbara in PA with a very useful sewing tip, and I never thought of it, but when they explained it, it's such a great idea. In the last episode, I mentioned my disappointment when I had my pattern pieces cut out on a very graphic, very obvious print, and the print was not lined up across the bottom of the pattern. There was a certain shifting going on. So the suggestion is, instead of making a pattern piece to sit on the fold of your fabric before cutting, to make a pattern piece by cutting on the fold of your interfacing or your Swedish tracing paper, whatever you decide to use, so that your pattern piece is actually a full pattern piece. And instead of cutting your pattern piece on the fold, you can open up your fabric and see exactly where your print is aligning with your pattern. How brilliant is that? And Barbara in PA even mentioned the importance of thinking about where a pattern falls. For example, if you have a pattern with some very obvious circular design, you don't want them, you know, planted squarely over the girls or something like that. So you can really see where the design is falling and you can line it up with your full pattern piece, and then you won't encounter any surprises after you cut. I will be trying that when I cut out this thistle fabric. It's a very bold and striking design, orange on black, and I feel like if there is any inconsistency or if I don't cut the dress pattern straight, you will really notice it very quickly. And in particular, I feel like it's important for the hemline to be even so you can see if there's any irregularity there. It's very easy to tell. At the top of the garment, it may not be so noticeable, but at the bottom, it certainly is. So thank you very much for that tip. And also, I'm considering maybe in the future the purchase of some Swedish tracing paper. I have not seen any at the places where I buy fabric, as far as I know. I'm sticking with this non-fusible interfacing, and I do have quite a lot of it. But I would like to experiment with Swedish tracing paper in the future, and I think it would be lovely once I work through all of the patterns in this Lotta Janstadter book to have, you know, a really nice version of each of the designs in that I've whittled down to a shape and a size that work perfectly for me. So maybe that will be like my final draft of the pattern I could put on Swedish tracing paper. I have not used the technique of making muslins so far. I guess there's a part of me that just feels like if I'm going to invest that amount of time, I really want a wearable garment. I think an idea that would work better for me is to use a really inexpensive fabric, maybe one that I don't even care that much for, to make an initial version of a garment. And then at least I have something wearable, even if I use it as like a work dress or, you know, just even kind of a smock idea where I don't care if I get dirt or dye or anything on it. But I have something that I can wear and use and learn from as I make it. So that's something to consider. I'll be looking for maybe some extreme sales on fabric to just have some things on hand. I also think I have not been making garments that are so difficult that I need to use a muslin, that I need to work it up. Maybe when I advance to more sophisticated versions of patterns, that might be more important to my process. I wish you all well with your cooking and your crafting this week. Thanks for joining me today.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, flurry as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. Music for this episode is Sweet. Music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider liking the show's Facebook page, joining the Yarns at Yinhu group on Ravelry, or leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
Just like Linda Kurtz sings, but out on a wire. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. nature's ever get you high till your face is mine. Jump a river naked, hike a country mile. It's a subway nature thing. It's a subway nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature.